All right, morning, everybody. Apologies to everybody. You get me today and not Chair Hornstein. He's in St. Cloud, so good luck to us all. I call the meeting to order, and we do have a quorum, and Representative Petersburg, do I have a motion for the minutes?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes of February 7th.
Thank you, sir. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Minutes are approved. So today we're doing overviews of government, the governor's budget, and so we have a presentation from MnDOT to begin. Not sure exactly who's ruling that yet. Commissioner Dobenberger? Thank you for being here. And once you get settled, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Dobenberger, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I am joined with my colleague, Josh Knatterud-Hubinger, here today, who is MnDOT's chief financial officer. Thank you for letting us provide to you today a summary of the MnDOT portion of the Governor's One Minnesota budget recommendations. MnDOT has 22 items in the governor's budget recommendation. The largest are the three top lines on this table, the multimodal transportation package, what is needed to maintain current levels of service, and along with the tab fee restructuring. So we'll go into a little more detail on those three, and then we'll touch briefly on the others on this table as well. The multimodal transportation package recommendation of $722 million general funds over 4 years is generally split between half and half between trunk highway needs and everything else transportation related in MnDOT's budget. And also the recommendations for $50 million in trunk highway bonds to provide matches for federal grants. So a little more detail on the first half. The $358 million is a recommendation for a general fund transfer to the trunk highway fund over 4 years. That is $90 million per year in trunk highway funds to provide $50.5 million as a base increase for state road construction. And that can be used as state match for IIJA federal funds. $22 million base increase for operations and maintenance. $12 million base increase for program planning and delivery, $5 million base increase for agency support, and then, as I mentioned, the $50 million trunk highway bonds to provide match for federal grants. And thank you for moving along so quickly. House File 26 that provided us the $315.5 million of budget authority that was needed to spend those federal dollars that came to us for the 22-23 biennium. Now for the other half of the multimodal transportation package, $364 million, is to remain as general funds for all non-trunk highway transportation needs. That's $100 million in one-time general funds to provide local match for federal grants, and that also provides for technical assistance and support for grant applications. And $66 million per year in general funds for non-highway project matches. And the five sub-bullets there list the five different areas that would need non-highway project matches. So EV charging infrastructure, Greater Minnesota Transit, state airport infrastructure, the small cities program for cities under 5,000 population, and discretionary grants. Now to touch on the tab fee restructuring. This is a recommended adjustment to the motor vehicle registration tax depreciation schedule. This would bring nearly $700 million in new highway user tax distribution fund revenues and would be broken down as follows. So $411 million for trunk highways, $227 million to county state aid highways, and $60 million to municipal state aid streets. This represents a 19% increase to tab fees over 4 years, but it represents a 6.5% increase to HUTD fund revenues overall over those 4 years. So how does this compare to the current tab fee structure? The first part of this slide lists what is part of the current law, and I'll just touch more so on the second half of the slide here and how that's different. So they both have the $10 plus 1.285% of the MSRP of a passenger vehicle, adjusted for depreciation. But currently, that depreciation starts with 100% MSRP in the first year. The proposed change would have depreciation beginning with 160% of the MSRP in the first year and then dropping to 100% in that second year. And they both then decline, both currently and in the proposed, by 10% each year. But for the proposed, then the tax for vehicles 11 years or older would be $30, compared to currently would be $35 each year. And it's important to note that almost half of the vehicles registered in Minnesota are 11 years old or older. This would be effective as of January 1st of 2024. This table shows how this would work for a new vehicle with a $40,000 purchase price. So in this example, the tab fee would increase by $308 in the first year. You can see that comparison on the top line of this table between the third column over the 40,000 new purchase current example, and then two over from that with the green heading 40,000 new purchase recommended example. So a $308 increase in the first year. But note that is less than 1% overall cost increase with the purchase of a vehicle of this magnitude. So over those first 11 years, a total of $776 would be paid by the owner. But then each year after that, they would pay $5 less per year if they were to hold on to that vehicle for over 11 years. And again, with nearly half of all vehicles being over 11 years old, those owners would be paying $5 less per year at that point, so $30 rather than $35 per year. And this slide shows a comparison of our current and proposed tab fee structures in comparison to neighboring states. So the blue the blue sloping line represents the current tab fee structure in Minnesota. The reddish orange shows the proposed restructure. So you can see the large increase in year one, and that's again where the MSRP is going from 100% to 160% in the proposed. Wisconsin is shown with the yellow flat line, and then Iowa is shown with the gray line. So with Wisconsin, they charge a flat fee of $85 per year, and Iowa, the gray line, charges tab fees based on a vehicle weight. So a normal vehicle, about 3,000 pounds, is about $412 per year for the first 7 years. Now on to the need for maintaining current service levels as part of this budget. This is to address needs for preserving existing purchasing power and compensation pressures. It would provide $135 million base trunk highway fund increase in the 24-25 biennium and $800,000 base general fund increase in that biennium and $1.2 million base 911 emergency fund increases in the 24-25 biennium. Now on to some of the smaller dollar amounts, but important. This next one talks about maximizing federal transportation climate funding. Minnesota is set to receive $290 million in total in formula funds for climate-related programs over the 5 years of IIJA. That's $68 million for the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, $120 million for the PROTECT Program, and almost $100 million for carbon reduction. This $2 million base general fund increase will provide us resources to leverage those federal funds. And it is important to note, too, that climate programs have competitive versions that cities, counties, and tribes and others can apply to directly. MnDOT owns and maintains the ARMOR system. That's the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response System. The recommendation is $2 million in one-time general funds to replace aging radio towers in buildings. Each cost about $1 million to replace. We own 333 towers, and this would get at two of those. The need is actually for 11 towers in need of replacement, but to at least start working at some of the replacement, this would get us partway. ARMOR is Minnesota's shared public safety communications system. It provides mobile radio coverage within all 87 counties. So when cellular networks do not quite hold up, such as like during the 35W bridge collapse or during social unrest, the ARMOR system communication backbone was strong and performed as needed. It's a very important public safety communication system in Minnesota. The next is the needs for strategic technology system investments. The recommendation is $3 million of one-time general funds, $4 million of base general fund increases, and these are to get at priority initiatives, systems for asset management, data document transfer, research project management systems. The one-time funds allow for implementation and modernization of core systems, applications, and platforms, and the base funds allow for that ongoing support and maintenance that would be needed. Local transportation disaster support. So there are two items noted here. The first one, $3.3 million one-time general funds to reimburse local public agencies for disaster spending. That would cover four state-declared disasters from 2018 to 2020. Now, on that, that's really just a placeholder at this point because I understand they will be receiving that from the Department of Public Safety in a few months. But the next one, the $1 million base general funds for future disaster relief, that would create a disaster relief contingency account that would be used to reimburse local public agencies. So that is a recommendation for a base general fund, $1 million. Rail crossing grade safety. We're recommending $750,000 in fiscal year 24 and $1.5 million starting in fiscal 25 as base trunk highway funds for the rail grade crossing safety account. And that is used for all rail safety improvements on the trunk highway and local road systems. Grade crossings cost approximately $300,000 per location to replace or repair. So $750,000 will replace 2 to 3 additional grade crossings in fiscal year 24, and the $1.5 million will replace 5 grade crossings annually. Aeronautic systems and investments. This is a $15 million one-time general fund recommendation to repair and replace automated weather observing systems, AWOS systems, which are also, this is the package that would help with replacement for needed navigational aids too. And many of our Minnesota's AWOS systems are out of production, past life expectancy, so there are quite a few needs here. But these AWOS systems provide critical weather information and aviation activities, including medical, air, commercial, and freight flights, and they're used by the National Weather Service for general forecasting as well. These are located at all of our publicly owned airports statewide. Utility aircraft replacement. So we have two utility aircrafts that we use very regularly. We call them our pickups in the sky. The $7 million is one-time general fund a recommendation to replace both of those. They're over 40 years old, have more than 9,000 hours on their time frame, and they are used to transport MnDOT technicians and parts like NAVAIDS to the airports around the state for time-sensitive repair needs. And this would minimize the impact of aviation equipment failures like AWOS or other NAVAIDS. Tribal Affairs Training Program. We have two recommendations here. The first is $900,000 base general funds for construction skills training program in Indian Country. Qualified workforce is a big challenge in the construction industry, so this $900,000 base general fund increase would provide consistent level program of construction skills training out in Indian Country throughout the state. And $100,000 base general fund increase for the tribal state relations training program that we've had in place for quite a while that MnDOT has in our budget. And that would provide a full-time employee to enhance virtual training options that were important during the pandemic and have been proven successful. So moving forward with that option. All right. Twin Cities, Milwaukee, Chicago, TCMC rail corridor. This request is for $893,200 in fiscal year 24 and $2.3 million in fiscal year 25 of one-time general funds for TCMC operating costs. So this is operating only for that amount and providing match dollars for federal grants that are in place. And also $4.9 million base general fund increase starting in fiscal 26 for Minnesota's share of ongoing TCMC operational costs. Stone Arch Bridge. This is a repair project that we are preparing plans for. A $5 million one-time general fund amount is needed for the repairs. This would be matching dollars for secured $24 million in federal funds that we have, but this would allow for the above water as well as the underwater repair work that is needed at this time. Right now there is enough to cover what's needed for underwater, but at this point to be able to have work done on the entire bridge for the entire amount that is needed would be good to have in all one contract and done at one time. MnDOT owns the Stone Arch Bridge, and that is per legislation that was passed a few decades ago. But we can't use trunk highway funds on it because it doesn't carry a trunk highway. City of Minneapolis is responsible for the bridge deck maintenance. And the weigh station program, recommending $1 million in base general funds for a weigh station program at MnDOT. And weigh stations are built and maintained by MnDOT and operated by Minnesota State Patrol's Commercial Vehicle Enforcement Division, essential for federally maintained size, weight, and safety enforcement program. And a reliable amount of base funding will allow for consistent maintenance and repair of state assets. Okay, rail safety inspectors. Now, this budget item would assess the cost of two additional rail safety inspectors to Class 1 and Class 2 railroads. It would still then remain our complement at six inspectors, but the request is to change the funding source. So it doesn't add any additional inspectors, but it would change the funding source so that that's assessed to the railroads. It's $300,000 additional cost, and four of the six are already being assessed to Class 1 and Class 2 railroads. Safe Routes to School extension. This would be to extend the Safe Routes to School appropriation. So funding was granted in 2021 in the first special session. It was $5 million in general funds that was appropriated. And it's available until just June 30th of this year, but we are seeking to extend it until June 30th of 25. Safe Routes to School program creates safe walking and biking paths to schools. Another request for extension here is our freight network optimization tool. So there was an appropriation also in 2021, the first special session, that was $1 million. And that, again, is also available only till June 30th of this year. And it was it's important to get this extension to move forward. We needed time to work with industry partners to develop the scope of this IT project. And it's now ready to go into procurement, but it needs an extension on the deadline. This next budget item, the meteorological towers registration fee, is not an ask for funds. It's asking to remove the $50 fee to register these towers. The administrative costs of collecting this fee is actually more than what we receive in revenues. So we are proposing to, again, not a funding request, but to remove this fee. And we do think that removing the fee may increase the registration compliance, which is important to know where these towers are, especially for navigational or aviation needs when it comes to potential obstructions in the airways. So important to get these registered, but the fee collection itself has been more cost to us than the actual fee coming in. The authority to charge for traffic control. So this budget item would permit MnDOT to collect traffic control costs. So MnDOT incurs staff time and equipment usage costs when we're responding to crashes or traffic incidents. And this is where we are seeking express permission to collect those costs from at-fault drivers and insurance companies, their insurance companies. And the last one we have here is the sustainable aviation fuel. This is a $3.2 million one-time general fund recommendation in fiscal year 24 and $2.1 million base general funds for developing a pilot-scale sustainable aviation fuel program. And that would be done in conjunction with other state agencies. The Department of Agriculture would administer this program, but we're recommending this pilot program funding comes through the MnDOT budget. It would create a sustainable aviation fuel development fund to pay for incentives for production and establish sustainable aviation fuel production goals for the state. So thank you for allowing MnDOT to present our portion of the One Minnesota budget. We stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We'll take about 10 minutes to answer any questions if there are some. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a few questions, and I'll try to be brief with the question and the answer. Now, the $722 million in general fund transfers or coming out of the general fund, on the next two pages you talk about the 358 and 364. I'm having trouble because I know that that's over two biennium. So I'm assuming the dollars you're putting here are for the first biennium, but I don't understand how it gets to the 358 and the 364. The numbers don't add up, or maybe I'm just double counting something or leaving something else out. Could you help me understand that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. So with the, maybe we could start with the $358 million, and that is for the transfer to trunk highway funds. That's $90 million per year, and then the $50 million on top of that would be for trunk highway bonds.
So 90 times 4 is 360 instead of 358. So
yeah, so the, right, so the 350.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
You're good. No, Commissioner, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, yeah, so the 358, it's roughly $90 million per year. And if you take that over 4 years, that's about $360 or $358 million. Okay. And then the additional $50 million is for trunk highway bonds. So general fund transfer and then bonds.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And I'm assuming the same is true of the other, that there's some rounding errors or rounding changes there that have an impact here. I noticed that throughout this presentation, there's an awful lot of base increases. Do we have a total figure on how much the transportation base budgets are going to be increased with this particular budget?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg. I'm going to defer to my CFO for that question.
Mr. Kanatter-Hubinger, did I say that right? Okay.
Very nicely done. For the record, again, Josh Kanatter-Hubinger, CFO at MnDOT. If you look at the table here, I don't know that we have a total for the base. We can easily get that for you. But just important to note that these, pretty much every sizable amount on this table is one-time funding. And for the most part, the base funding are those smaller amounts. So when you see these large dollar amounts, the base funding is a very small percentage of the overall total.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and if we could get that base funding piece, I think that would be helpful because it may sound small, but when we are dealing with very small increases in the HUDD growth, it's important to know what those bases are because that extends what our cost is going to be into the future with reducing revenue sources. That's important. The last question I'm just going to ask is just on railroad safety inspectors, and it's something that's always been a concern for me, is that what in the history or past has led to the department not having confidence in the rail inspectors that the railroads themselves actually have? And the reason why I ask that is because I know OSHA and a lot of other agencies provide their own inspections when they aren't sure that the inspecting is going on, or they do something to verify the quality of the inspections rather than assessing, because I don't know of any other industry that actually pays not only for their own inspectors but for the government inspectors as well. And this just seems like kind of an oddity. And so if you give me some background as to how and why this came about, I appreciate that.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg. So I believe this was in state statute as a requirement a few years ago, and the history on that, what it came from, I believe has to do with some oversight needed on railroads inspectors to provide a program to look at that consistently throughout the state. But with that, I'm going to look at my CFO, CFP, or anyone else here knows any more history on that. Mr. Chair, if I could.
We might phone a friend.
For sure. Ms. Rudine, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. And I believe that the rail inspection program was created because there was a feeling that the existing inspectors provided by the railroads, as well as some federal railroad administration inspectors, were not doing an adequate job of inspecting the rail system in the state. And we are working on some information. We had a request from the railroads recently, so we're pulling together some information about the number of inspections that are performed annually, as well as the number of findings or citations that the state rail inspectors find on an annual basis. And it is a fairly significant number. I don't have that with me, but we can certainly get that for you.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg, any follow-up?
Yeah, just quickly. So I believe that same premise is the reason why we have other inspectors. And if it was just to review the quality of the inspectors that the railroad has, that would be one thing. But in this particular case, it's actually replacing and doing duplication. And so, and when you talk about, well, your inspectors covered up, found these things wrong, if it's true that the railroad also did and has corrected it before the inspectors could actually even put in a report, isn't that redundancy? And second of all, it seems that if the railroads had agreed to four inspectors and the state wanted two more and have paid for it at this particular, up to this particular time, because of the feeling that the state needs that support, again, why should the railroad companies have to pay for it? It's just a question that I ask, and we'll have further debate on it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Well, this will all, just to make sure everybody knows, this will all be coming back to us multiple times into the future. So we'll save those detailed type questions for that point, if that's all right.
Yep.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably want our numbers guy up there. I'm just kind of curious about formula versus discretionary funding. And so is the multimodal transportation package, the 358, is that formula or is there discretionary in there as well?
Mr. Canada, you hear me, turn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle. So there's a couple places where it the distinction between formula and discretionary shows up. So $358 million of trunk highway funds. So this is money coming one time from the general fund, then available over the next 4 years over the life of IIJA. But largely it's that first sub-bullet, that $50 million of state road construction. The math would say we need about $40 million a year for the formula component of trunk highway funds of the new IIJA federal funds. So conceptually, about another $10 million is left over for discretionary there. That $50 million of trunk highway bonds would be available for discretionary because those are available for 4 years, so there's some more flexibility. And then kind of conceptually for the $364 million of one-time general funds, the $100 million is for discretionary. That's a kind of one-time pot. And then the rest of the bullets are basically for the formula components, except for the $10 million for small cities. That's just a statutory program going to those small cities, not really related to IIJA. And then there's that additional $29 million a year there for discretionary ongoing too.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the $29 million, is that specifically for state-funded applications? So that would be state applications for IIJA?
Mr. Knetter-Huminger.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So the general idea is that $100 million is for locals and assistance, and then that $29 million a year is for kind of all modes, so any eligible entity depending on the grant program, which is different for each program. So really anybody.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wow, that's a really loud mic over here. Usually on the other side, the mics aren't that loud. So my question is in regard to this tab fee restructure, this tax. And my biggest question is, can you explain the reasoning behind changing the depreciation from 100% to 160%? Is there some form of math that would state that a more expensive, newer vehicle does more damage to the road, or would in some way, shape, or form cost more to the Department of Transportation? This seems to me like it's a money grab to try and increase $700 million worth of taxes on our Minnesota taxpayers. If you look at the idea by the states, you've got seven states that are value-based taxes, including the state of Minnesota. You've got 12 that determine it based off of weight, which kind of makes sense to me. I would assume that a heavier vehicle actually costs more, more damage to the road. And then more than half of the states, you know, they start getting really small when you start counting on the map. You know, Connecticut, Rhode Island are pretty small. So I might be a little bit wrong, but it looked like it was about 27 states are a flat tax. They say, hey, you're all on the road, whether you're on the road with something that costs $900 or you're on the road with something that costs $900,000, you are on the road. Can you please explain to me and at least assure me that this isn't just a money grab for people who are trying to buy newer vehicles?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, for that question. So this proposal would bring in that longer-term sustainable additional transportation that funding that's needed to address needs across our system. So even though we've, in many parts of this budget, are requesting one-time funds, this would get at some of those ongoing needs. And the increase in the first year, I believe, is proposed due to when someone would buy a vehicle, typically, or very oftentimes, people finance that. And that additional cost does come to less than 1% of the overall cost of buying a vehicle. So that's proposed right in that upfront vehicle purchase cost, and then depreciates as we have in the current structure, starting in year two.
Representative Olson.
So there is no, there's obviously no correlation between the value of a vehicle, right? That was me being a little bit sarcastic. This appears to me as though it is just one more way in which we can slap our taxpayers in the face while hiding it. So when you go to buy a new vehicle, I just purchased a new one in December. Now it was a two-year-old vehicle, so the value of it wasn't that expensive in comparison to a newer vehicle. But when you're buying a vehicle, And it says, well, this is going to cost you, you know, $27,000. And then you think to yourself, okay, now what's the hidden fees here? You know, because remember, they always say, oh, this is $27,000 plus tax, title, and licensing fees. And you're like, okay, so is that $5,000? Is that $4,000? I got to pay state sales tax on top of this. And by the end of it, you walk out of there and you're $30,000 down on this $27,000 vehicle. You're $35,000 down. I think it's shameful that we're hiding these things from taxpayers. I think that finding a way, you know, you talk about a gas tax, everyone sees that price. Everyone recognizes it sits there right there on the gas pump. It says the state of Minnesota is receiving this amount of money in that little sticker. There's a little sticker that says it. It absolutely does. It says the federal is getting this much and the state is getting this much. right there for the taxpayers. If you want to buy the gas, you can buy the gas. If you don't want to, there's no hidden fees there on that gas. This is a hidden fee. I think it's shameful.
It wasn't a question.
Yeah, I understand that. I just want to make sure that everybody understands that this is not hidden by any stretch of the imagination, that this is absolutely something that is publicized. Everybody knows every year when they get their tab fees that is very well directed to the taxpayer. And we've got one more person on the list, then we're going to move on to DPS. But, Commissioner, I just want to ask, based off of Representative Olson's questions there, and you haven't really covered it today, we've got a very large surplus on the general fund side of things, and transportation is experiencing different funding mechanisms and how that is working, and we've got a lot of tax increases in here. Can you explain why that is necessary for the future and the reasoning for that from your perspective?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. Yes, MnDOT is in the process of updating our 20-year Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, call it our MNCHIP. And as a part of that, we're assessing revenues based on what we currently receive for revenues, as well as the needs out on the system over the 20 years. And at this point, we, even though we're in the process of getting input on what those investment categories should have funded based on revenues, overall, we are seeing a gap to the effect of it's 18 to 27 billion dollars over the 20 years. And so, again, even though IIJA has brought in to Minnesota, all states, a nice influx of federal funds, that is a four-year bill, and we do have these ongoing needs.
Got it. Thank you. Representative Sensenmayer, and then we'll move on to DPS.
Sounds good. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. My question might need to be a bigger conversation, maybe with your office at some point, but I have a few constituents who've raised some concerns to me just about MnDOT's progress on the diversity goals in terms of hiring and treatment of workers and worker safety. Specifically, I have some constituents who were involved in a situation at the Fond du Lac Band burial site, which I know that MnDOT has kind of been in this situation with for a few years. But I guess I'm wondering if you can kind of talk more generally about progress on diversity goals and also how your office is, you know, kind of handling any complaints about civil rights violations, and then maybe I would love to set up a time with your office to dive deeper into this constituent issue. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, we'd be happy to dig into some details on what our goals are, how we're making progress toward those. I would just maybe say, though, for this budget recommendation to have funding for the tribal package, so tribal state relations training package and the construction skills training series that we want to continue out in greater Minnesota, out in Indian country around the state. That does help us achieve those goals of not only working toward equity, but again with our own needs of our workforce as well as our contractors' workforce, city and county workforce, to get those skills out there so that they're qualified people who can apply for these jobs really helps us advance equity in the department.
Thank you very much. Any follow-up, Senator?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much to MnDOT for your presentation. We appreciate you being here, and we're going to move on to DPS now. So we've got Commissioner Jacobson. And we've got Commissioner Jacobson, Colonel Langer, Director Hansen, Chief Engineer Wolfgram, and Wolfgram, and Director Pong Zhang, who will be speaking. And if we could keep this to 15 to 20 minutes, I would appreciate it. And continue.
All right. Good morning, Chair Tappy, Lead Petersburg, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and thanks for having the Department of Public Safety here today to discuss our budget requests. And I will try to keep it as quick as I can, sir.
Thank you.
On the first slide, we'll talk about funding to maintain current service levels. Again, this is an adjustment. The Department of Public Safety has over 2,000 employees statewide. They are committed to delivering quality care and services, and as with all businesses and government services, we're seeing an increase in the costs associated with our current work. That includes factors like inflation and IT costs. This operating adjustment would allow our division to maintain current level of service, and it covers State Patrol, DBS, traffic safety, and DPS support services through their funding sources. We also are asking for an adjustment with DPS administration. While divisions like the State Patrol, DBS, and others certainly are the more public-facing divisions, internally we also have human services, communications, fiscal administrative services, tribal and government relations, and they're all critical to our work. Without additional funding for these support divisions, we cannot properly function. We're asking for funds for community engagement, which is very important to the Department of Public Safety. It's critical, it's necessary for all the ongoing work that DPS does. Specifically, we want to grow our capacity to engage in meaningful community engagement, training opportunities for collaboration, and certainly for DVS road changes, or DVS changes, road safety, and more. And again, this would help us best be able to serve the public. We're also looking for funding for a strategy and analytics team to establish a centralized analytics team. It would serve as a resource for agency leadership in the areas of strategy, analytics, evaluation, and performance management and improvement. This type of service is used across other areas of state government. State rail safety oversight staff. Part of DPS only has one office employee, to staff that. It's responsible for ensuring Minnesota's light rail infrastructure meets safety standards so it can remain safe for the hundreds of thousands of riders and communities that serve by light rail trains, and includes oversight of Metro Transit safety procedures and equipment. And as you know, Metro Transit light rail system is growing and set to double over the next few years. And then the last item is soft body armor moving to the public safety budget. That's also very important. The agency is requesting to move our soft body armor funding to public safety. This has historically been funded out of the transportation budget. However, moving this funding to public safety appropriately broadens the to meet the needs of our vast public safety professionals in the state of Minnesota. And with that, we welcome Colonel Langer to continue.
Thank you very much, Colonel Langer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Langer. For the record, I have the honor and privilege of serving as Chief or Colonel of the Minnesota State Patrol. And if we go to the next slide, we've got just a few things here that we're seeking this year. The first is an important deficiency request for this fiscal year at $6.8 million to cover increased costs that basically come in three buckets. About $4.4 million is related to salary, about $1.2 million is related to the increased cost of new squad cars, and about $1.3 million is due to increased cost in fuel. That's a need for this fiscal year only as a deficiency request. Second is State Patrol Aviation. We have a request for a new twin-engine helicopter. This also includes four additional pilots. You've heard probably in the news, and I believe I testified once previously to this just momentarily, that our aviation services have really been, their use has been expanded. We're doing a lot more. We're flying 25% more than we have in the past, specifically to help with some of the violent crime challenges and also the pursuit mitigation strategies that really help make our roads safer and help apprehend those that are on the run as safely as possible for everyone involved. But our aviation unit also does a lot of work in Greater Minnesota related to search and rescue, whether it's someone with a broken leg in the Boundary Waters or an Alzheimer patient that has wandered away from a facility or a home. Those are things that we do quite regularly, also with the Minnesota Aviation Response Team, which is a partnership with the St. Paul Fire Department. So this would expand our helicopter fleet from the current two single-engine helicopters to three with the additional of a twin engine. The twin engine can fly higher, it's safer, it's a bit faster. In some ways, it's actually more efficient, which is kind of counterintuitive, but that's what the maintenance projections tell us. And it also, importantly, has a hook rescue capabilities, so you can do hook rescues with a winch system, which allows us to do nighttime rescue, and currently we cannot do that, and the only entity that can do that in Minnesota is an activation of the Minnesota National Guard, which is difficult when someone has a compound fracture somewhere in the state of Minnesota. The next one is a commercial vehicle enforcement. This basically allows us to access the federal funds that are available, so it's an increase to the base budget of commercial vehicle enforcement. It requires state funding in order to access those federal funds. These dollars would be put to use for additional education, industry work, and in commercial vehicle enforcement work across the state of Minnesota. And then the last one is CALEA accreditation. So this is essentially FTE money that would be to have staff experts to come in, be members of the State Patrol, employees of the State Patrol, but their goal would be to work us as an organization through accreditation. CALEA is really the sole entity that does that. There's a very intentional and specific, laborious, long process to do that work. Hoping to identify problems that might be lying in wait or things that we can do better. That would focus on the organization as a whole. It would also focus on our academy environment, and it also has a dispatch component too, so it's a rather comprehensive and actually very admittedly difficult process, but one that we think is important for us into the future.
Thank you very much, Colonel Langer. Next up we have Director Hansen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Hansen, and I have the privilege of serving as the Director for the Department of Public Safety's Office of Traffic Safety. And I will bring up our information here. The first proposal that you see in front of there is a Traffic Safety Improvement and Governing Council recommendation. What this will do and what the funding will support is additional resources to create and support the Traffic Safety Advisory Council. It will also be used to provide the resources and the support for our local safe roads coalitions across the state. This will support the Towards Zero Deaths program reorganization, which our partners at MnDOT and the Department of Health have been working on for about the last year and a half. And we want to bring some structure and some organization and, most importantly, some state resources to the TZD program, which will then, again, support those local safe roads coalitions with training, with equipment, with materials, and educational outreach ability. And then finally, this will also help us to with our match requirement for all of the federal highway safety dollars that we receive from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. As I think all members are aware, the IGER legislation meant a significant increase in the transportation budgets across the country, including in the safety arena. Our budget will go up by somewhere about 20% or more in the federal traffic safety dollars we receive, and we have to match those either at a 20% or a 50% level, depending on what program or what project that we're using that federal funding for. The second item that you see there is a Traffic Safety Data Analytics Center. Everything that we do at OTS to try and solve the tough traffic safety issues that we face in Minnesota and across the country is based on data. We've got a lot of data out there from a lot of different sources. The problem is, how do we bring that data together in a real and usable way so that we can take our analytics to that next level? And with the proper funding, the proper resources, we can obtain the software and have the staff that will enable us to really take our analytics capability to that next level, which is really going to be the key to significantly improving traffic safety across the state. So being able to use all of that data in a real-world way, in a real-time way, makes us much more efficient, much more flexible, and able to solve those problems. And then finally, the last item that you see there is funding for a pilot project authorizing roadside testing for drivers who are suspected of a drug impairment and not alcohol alone. And what the funding will support is training for the advanced roadside testing for drug-impaired drivers that we provide to law enforcement. It will support the training program for the drug recognition evaluators across the state. It will help us to buy the equipment that we need to test and validate. It's currently in use in over other 20 other states across the country. And so Minnesota just needs to catch up a little bit and to certify these units, much the same way that the alcohol PBT that law enforcement uses right there. And then finally, the instruments that we're going to use in the pilot project will enable us to get a much clearer picture of the prevalence of drug-impaired driving on Minnesota roads. Right now, we don't really know how frequent this is occurring or how significant the multi-substance abuse, people who are using more than one substance at a time out there. These instruments will help us to gather that data so that we can develop the countermeasures to prevent those offenses from occurring in the first place. Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Chief Engineer Wolfgram.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Wolfgram. I'm the Deputy Director for the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. To our slide here. Thank you for the opportunity to provide more information regarding our budget proposal. This proposal involves aspects of
the Mr. Wolfgram, could you move a little closer to the mic,
sure,
of course?
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thank you.
Students. I'll start from the top here again. Our proposal here for you today involves aspects of the Office of Pipeline Safety's oversight over state dam intervention laws, or our call before you dig laws. These laws aim to keep contractors as well as the public safe when digging around underground utilities. These laws include our oversight over natural gas pipelines, electric lines, sewer, water, as well as telecommunication lines. These laws also protect underground utilities from excavation-related damages. An average of 1,800 utility damages are reported to OPS each year. Pipeline and utility damages can lead to injuries, fatalities, property damage, as well as environmental impact. OPS receives complaints on a numerous basis from excavation contractors on the timeliness of utility locate companies coming out to their job sites to mark their utilities on time before their projects begin. The Office of Pipeline Safety is requesting a dedicated funding source for three staff to be used for education, investigation, and enforcement pertaining to the state dam intervention laws, Minnesota Statute 216D. The staff would respond to increasing complaints, investigate utility damages, and carry out necessary enforcement. Funding would also be used for education of contractors, farmers, utility companies, as well as members of the public. The state dam intervention laws in Minnesota Statute 216D aim to keep people, property, and the environment safe. These laws aim to keep contractors operating in a timely manner and digging safe when we're working around utilities. State dam intervention laws also aim to ensure the safe and reliable delivery of services to homes and businesses. I'd be happy to take any questions at the conclusion of the commissioner's presentation.
Thank you very much. Director Zhang, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Here at DVS, we serve over 11 million customers across driver's license, IDs, vehicle registrations, and license plates, and much more. We have several proposals to share with you all today, the first of which is to continue the one-time funding from FY22-23. This funding was used to reopen all the 93 exam stations. It also allows us to have the efficiency that we've seen this year. And this last calendar year, we had a record number of exams provided for both CDL and Class D. This next proposal is to increase the number of vehicle inspection sites, additional 12 employees and 5 new sites across the state. This next proposal is to eliminate the out-of-state knowledge test. This is an IER recommendation, and this would just reduce the barriers for from folks coming into the state who are already licensed. This next proposal is to allow for Minnesotans to renew their credential or their ID or driver's license every other cycle online. This will just create a convenience for Minnesotans that we think will best serve Minnesotans. These next two proposals, the race and ethnicity data on applications and DL for all, have already been heard in this committee, and we're excited to continue that conversation. We also have several revenue generators that we're proposing as well. the first of which is to combine the DSOA and VSOA operating accounts. This will just allow for the accounts to be integrated into one, but it still will allow for the legislature to provide direct appropriations to each of the services. The next proposal is a blackout special plate. This will be a special plate that will be increase the revenue for our vehicle services operating account. This next proposal here is to authorize DVS to share SSN numbers with the Department of Revenue for the sake of revenue recapture, and will allow us to collect the debt that the DVS is currently carrying. This next proposal is to reinstate the 75 cents real ID driver's license fee. This will again just match the or continue that funding that allowed us to provide services. The next is to increase DVS increase the DVS credential fee. This will allow for revenues to match the expenses out of that account. The DS account supports all DS driver services functions throughout the state beyond just the credential. And the last of which is an IER recommendation, which is to increase the filing fee. This is a transaction cost when customers come in to make applications at one of our locations or one of our partner locations. And the fee increases, again, are part of the IER recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much, everyone. And we're going to take about 10 minutes for questions here. But before Mr. Zhang gets too far away, I just want to say thank you to you. My oldest just turned, you take a lot of heat for driver's license testing and all that kind of stuff. And my oldest just turned 16 on Monday. And we got it scheduled right away for a test. It's local, and she's got that coming up here in a couple weeks. So I just want to say that the system worked perfectly, and I just appreciate all you do. So thank you for that. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and this would be for Mr. Zhang as well. Because I do have quite a few questions, I want to just remind a lot of people on this committee that may be new here, that we have gone through a major change in the last 10 years since I've been here in regards to the driver's license program and so forth. We had the legacy system that got changed into Midlar system, which was at best a fiasco in implementation, and then moving on to MinDrive. But during that time, our deputy registers were inundated with a lot of extra work and stuff for it, and they're still struggling to get some of their footing back. And a couple of things within this budget leads me a concern in regards to how those are funded. For example, renewing online driver's license every other cycle, and it looks like there's going to be a revenue increase of $1.8 million. I'm assuming that $1.8 million is the additional fees that will be collected by the state rather than deputy registers, which means that the deputy registers are getting that much less over a four-year span as well. So I think that's a concern. And if you could kind of talk about that, and then I got a question about a few other filing fees.
Mr. Zhang.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Petersburg, that is correct. The revenue that we're forecasting there is the credit or the filing fees that we would expect to see come through the online system. We know that some will leverage the system. We've made a conservative estimate on how many people we think would actually leverage the online renewal. But we recognize that some of that traffic would move to the online platform.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other question is on the last page here. Somehow I'm not tracking as to how this works. We're reinstating a 75-cent real ID license fee that's bringing in $958,000 per year. But the fee increases for filing, going from 8 to 11 and 8 to 16, is only bringing in half as much. I mean, it seems that should be reversed. So how is it that 75 cents up here is only bringing 958, and the filing fees that are going up anywhere from $3 to $8 is only bringing in half? And I realize a lot of it is being done by deputy registers, but that seems quite a big discrepancy there.
Director Zhang.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Petersburg. the 75-cent surcharge only applies to real ID fees, and it does apply broadly to all real ID applications, new and renewals. The filing fee increase, as you correctly stated, will be based on the state transactions that we anticipate, and our deputy registrar partners, our DLA partners, produce the majority of those applications. Over 70% of driver's license applications are actually handled by our partners, and so that smaller amount is representing the portion that we think will be conducted by state employees.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I anticipated that. I didn't realize it was quite that drastic a difference. I appreciate that. And I was going to inquire, and just briefly, the credential fee increase by $6, what does that bring it up to then?
Mr. Zhang.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Petersburg, the credential fee increase will be, our estimate will bring in $8.9 million per year.
Representative Petersburg.
But do we know what the final cost will be for the individual for the credential fee, or is that varying depending on what credential it is?
Mr. Zhang.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Petersburg, that is correct. Depending on what endorsements a person will carry, the type of credential they're applying for, Class D or CDL, those costs may vary.
Okay.
But it would be a $6 increase to that credential fee across the board.
All right. Thank you. And then if I could have one, Mr. Chair?
Yep, Mr. Petersburg.
Could I have one question for Colonel Langer?
Yes, Colonel Langer. And we've got a couple folks on the list here, and just a couple minutes left in this discussion before we move on to Met Council. And so if we could keep everybody keep questions to overarching questions about the budget, we'll, as I said before, we'll have lots of time in the future to get to dive deep into all these. So Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a quick question. You had touched a little bit about the academies, and I know the department is really struggling on getting staff in place and getting the academies filled. Is there anything in the budget that is helping that particular piece out?
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, great question. So we're currently having two academies a year to maintain the status quo. That's a big shift for us. Academies are a big undertaking for us. They're expensive, but they're really critical for the success of the State Patrol. So to have two academies every year to maintain our staff and not yet been able to crawl up to the 63 new FTEs that the legislature had funded a couple of years ago is a real challenge for us. So the answer to your question is that's part of what's driving our deficiency in 2020, this fiscal year in 2023, and it's also part of the overall DPS operating adjustment is for us to be able to recapture those costs of just it's more expensive to have the employees we have right now given the environment that we're working in, and it's more expensive to hire, recruit, and train them and equip them given the cost pressures we have.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and thank you, Colonel Langer, for what you do, and I hope we can be successful because it's an important part of our safety. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to Representative Lead Petersburg's question about the DVS stuff, Chair Hornstein and Chair Dibble have given Senator Jasinski and I the permission to carry this issue going forward. So Alexis Stengel in the Senate is currently drafting up a bill based on the King report that would reflect where we had what we had agreed on last May in the conference committee report. I'm hoping that Mr. Burress is going to be working with her. The two of them work very closely together in putting together that bill for last May. But it will be our starting point. It will come here, and we will have that discussion.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, one of the first slides that talked about maintaining current service levels going from 20.6 million to 29.9 million. That's a large percentage increase around something maintaining current staffing needs. Can you just what's going on with that?
Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, again, it does appear like it's a large increase, but it really is based on increase in cost for labor, increase in cost of living increases, health insurance, new laptops. Our laptops with the State Patrol, their warranties have expired, so significant increase in cost for just maintaining, the equipment that we provide and that we use each and every day to provide those services.
Representative Kraft. Thank you. Representative Cagle.
My question is for Director Hansen.
kind of curious about the traffic safety data analytics center. How will this data be used? And how will the data be used?
Representative Cagle, great question. And there's a variety of different ways that we can use that data. And eventually, if we can get into a predictive mode, we can identify the likelihood of an event taking place and then take proactive steps to prevent that from taking place eventually. But there's all kinds of different ways that we can pull the different data sets together now from a bunch of different places that will allow us to take a different look at the data and what it tells us. For years and years, our historical database has been crash records. We look at crash records to determine the who, what, when, where, why, and how a crash occurs, and then develop countermeasures from that. The crash records are kind of reactive after the fact. There's a lot of data sources out there now that will allow us to move to the next generation, to the proactive, looking at near misses and things like that. Third-party data sets. Our friends at MnDOT have incredible sets of data, but bringing it all together in a way that we can use it is the challenge that we have right now.
Representative Cagle.
Yeah, I think that's great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see this as maybe something that, having like that stretch of University Avenue by my house where everybody, we dragged y'all up there and made you climb the snowbanks, I see that as something that could have really highlighted that area quicker instead of just me complaining all the time. And then the roadside testing for drug impairment drivers, I'm sure everybody knows what I'm going to say, but we have to really examine then how we are allowing people to get reinstated and making sure that the punishment or the punishment fits the crime. So just had to get that in there again. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sensor-Mira, and then we're going to move on to Met Council.
Thank you. And my question is also for Chair Hansen and relates to the drug impaired drivers pilot project. We have the adult use cannabis bill that is going through the legislature right now. When I heard it yesterday in workforce, there was some mention about a pilot project that they are doing around specifically cannabis testing and, essentially trying to figure out if we can get science to give us the kind of rapid response testing that you get from alcohol. Is this using that same kind of technology? Like when you're saying drugs, is it all drugs? Are you specifically talking about cannabis? Just because I know that, cannabis impaired driving is one of the main concerns that people have around passing that piece of legislation. Thank you.
Director Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, another really good question. And yes, the technology is exactly that. There's a company out there that does have a product that looks for cannabis specifically. The instruments that we're looking at testing, though, are a little bit more broad-based. There's six to eight drug categories that we can look for using the technology that we would utilize in this pilot project. Recent use cannabis is one of those. Without getting too far down in the weeds and kind of over my head on the cannabis part of it, the part of cannabis that makes somebody high, that's in the body for a relatively short period of time, and that's what we want to look for when it comes to that roadside testing, is that recent use. And so that's the instruments that we're looking to pilot and to certify for use.
Representative Sensor-Mira.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for being here.
Appreciate your
time.
Thank you.
And now we're going on Chair Zelli from Met Council. Chair Zelli, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. It's my honor to be here today to present the governor's recommended budget. I'm Charlie Zelli, chair of the Metropolitan Council. I will just be fairly brief, and then we have other experts in the room if we have questions that I can answer. First and foremost in the governor's recommendation is the proposal for a dedicated sales tax in the metro area. This is at an eighth of a percent, so modest, but recurring sustainable funding is really something that has been sought for many years. Transit has a structural deficit, and in fact, not this biennium, but the next biennium, it would be as much as $260 million that is unfunded with the current operations. As everyone may know, we are expanding our system, both with transitways, large capital projects, and the arterial bus rapid transit, which I'll talk about in a minute. Their need for not just operating costs and increasing operating costs, given the increases in operator pay, increases in our Metro Transit Police Force, and then, of course, additional needs in areas such as safety. This is the kind of the projection for what we would expect from a revenue stream over the next, over a four-year period from that eighth of percent. Again, as background, much as you've heard with MnDOT, a lot of our funding comes from the motor vehicle sales tax, which is less than its previous forecast. So it's kind of going the wrong way, which adds to the deficit. So I'll just talk a little bit about the capital improvement program, which is the governor's recommendation for in the bonding program. This is the ABRT, the $72 million being proposed will help advance the next three lines, the F line, the G line, and the H line. I'll talk about them in a minute. But as you know, this funding could be augmented by additional federal funds, and we know that there are other costs associated with ABRT, not just the project costs. Cost of local governments to improve roadways, ADA accessibility, signaling. But it is a system that has had a tremendous success, and I often say relative success. If you think about the dampening of demand during the COVID, the ABRT lines are the ones that are coming back the fastest. The A line, the C line, and no more recently the D line are in service. The B line is under construction. And of course, there is also the E line, which is under planning as well. So these next three are really helping fill out this map of an interconnected transit system. If you think about the large transitways augmented by the ABRT, it all fits with one system along with our regular scheduled bus routes. And really through these connections, you'll see these lines, many of them are not just through the city centers. They're a way to kind of get from here to there around the metro, in many cases, in less than 30 minutes, rather than that long hour and a half kind of connection that's so inefficient. These ABRT systems are more express. They have ticketing in enhanced stations. They don't have to pull over. They stay in their lane of traffic. And they even have a little gizmo that helps the traffic lights turn green. I think it has really part of the future of this transit system because of the efficiency of these ABRTs. It makes all this become a network because there never is one line that makes sense. It's how they all kind of fit together. Just quickly on these three lines, and I won't go into length, but as you can see, this north-south line going north from Minneapolis, the F line ends in the Northtown Transit Center, really connects a lot of the this northern area to the city. I would just also kind of emphasize that this isn't just a commuter service. This is all day, every 10 minutes. This is not just about getting to your job. It's about getting to the grocery store, about getting to school, about getting to medical services, really how people live their lives. And that's been the success of these programs, is to know that you don't need to kind of check the app and see when the next bus is coming in an hour. It's coming if you just wait by the station. And a lot of that efficiency, like the signal preemption, isn't just making it faster. It makes this service very reliable. You can count on those that frequency staying on a schedule. Again, additional routes, the G line on the East Metro. Again, not necessarily following the large interstates. This is a route that is very heavily traveled now, but it's the Rice Street-Robert corridor, again, north-south, but has great connections with other transitway development. And then the longest and most perhaps robust future ABRT is the H line, many east-west along Como, Maryland corridor. This is an area kind of north of the 94 travel shed, but covers a lot of communities, and again a very popular route. And we know that this too would make great connections with some of our transitways under development. So shifting quickly to our capital program recommended through the operating budget is a $29 million for one-time use to advance our electric bus program. This would pay for 30 buses, but a lot of this electrification requires not just buses, but the actual charging systems, the integration with the grid, and how we kind of maintain it again as a system. Our new garage is going to be equipped with charging stations. We work very closely with Xcel. With this funds, we're able to use not just to buy and upgrade the additional cost for electrifying buses, but it would also be a match for some discretionary programs as part of the IIJA bill. And so we think this could leverage even more procurement and maybe get ahead of our plan, which is to be 20% zero emission by 2027. We could really we consider that a floor. We want to beat that, and I think this additional funds would allow us the flexibility to do that. This is a bonding authority. We have issue our own bonds as a separate agency, and we regularly provide capital support for buses primarily throughout the metro, including Metro Transit, but others as well. And this is kind of a recurring program. We seek legislative authorization to issue the bonds, but there will be our bonds. And we would actually pay for our portion of these funds with our own tax property tax levies. Again, this is really there to match federal funds, so the actual program is even more robust, but it's a very good program for us because we put up the 20% and there's a regular FGA program for bus procurement. That is a quick fly through our governor's recommendations, and I'm ready to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Chair Zelli. We've got about 10 minutes for questions, then a couple announcements, and then we'll be adjourning. Representative Petersburg, do you want to lead or you want to end?
I can wait.
Okay, got it. So we're going to go to Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Zelli, question. As I look back when you came before us on January 17th and presented the budget and some of the deficits that you had, and I look at the numbers presented today, it doesn't appear that closes the gap. Am I missing something there, or how do we think about that?
Chair Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that this additional funds makes a great progress toward closing the gap. There are needs in excess of what is being presented, but at the very least covers the structural deficit and contributes toward some of the unmet capital needs. So we believe this this 8 cent, if I go back, is covers approximately $350 million over that four-year period.
Representative Kraft.
I have to thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got to look at the numbers.
Okay, thank you. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a question. And Mr. Chair, if you could provide me with a little bit more clarification. I'm looking at this proposal, and it's got a lot of great conversation starters about different routes and things like that. I guess my question is, what particularly is the Met Council going to do about rider safety? Because I personally have had some very adverse, very uncomfortable situations my first week of the legislature that causes me to not ride the light rail any longer.
Chizelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no question. Safety not only is our first priority, it's just an urgent concern. We recognize the challenges mostly in our platforms and our trains. We are not only advancing our 40-point plan, which involves more defensive architecture enhancements, everything from live cameras to kind of safety zones, really about training, and then really augmenting our police force. We know that we can't do this alone. The public space of transit becomes the downstream symptom from large addiction, mental health issues, but that doesn't mean we can't ignore it. And so we're working with counties, with many partners. In fact, we're now working with private security because the workforce shortage has really hurt not just operators, but our police officers. And so we're contracting with private security firms, particularly in station areas. We're now working, and we'll actually be deploying more patrols with some other law enforcement agencies that we could do more cooperative work. I think that there is no silver lining, but if there is one, there is more cooperation and more serious conversations among not just law enforcement agencies, but local governments, state agencies, on how we can get our minds around the safety threat. These transit ways are part of people's everyday experience. And if it's not safe, if it's not welcoming for both our customers and our employees, we can't be in business. So we know this goes through cycles. We're not alone. We talk regularly with other systems around the country, developing some best practice. We know that this won't improve without our concerted effort. So I actually look forward to continuing ongoing conversations to report as to how we're doing and the successes. We've seen some successes. And I know with Mr. Representative Tadke and Representative Elkins, we're actually looking at some very specific things that could be helpful in legislation this session, including a way to kind of lean into fare enforcement in a new way that we can actually follow through on. And so I think you'll hear or have heard about that. But I think there is no one answer, and I could be here for well beyond 10 minutes, but I look forward to these ongoing reports.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just mention, I won't go into specifics or details here, but I did send an email to your GR person specifically detailing what I experienced my first week here at the legislature this year. What I will say is I have the ability to not ride the light rail. I chose to because of the convenience, and of course, you know, I don't need to drive if I can just ride the light rail. A lot of folks don't have that opportunity, and so I want to ensure that there's safe passage to and from wherever they're going. So I appreciate your dedication to addressing that.
Yeah,
thanks.
Point well taken.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I greatly appreciated the comments from the representative from Nicollet County regarding the safety of our transit system, but also looking through this entire presentation, you've got a lot of grandiose ideas and plans of expansion and expansion and expansion. Now, we spend a lot of money on our roads, we spend a lot of money on our bridges, we spend a lot of money on our transit, and my biggest concern is how are we making those dollars as efficient as possible? You know, just because we're reaching out as far as we can doesn't make it efficient. Can you explain to me what the Met Council is doing in order to try and make this a more efficient thing? Talk about ridership with regard to COVID. How are we at? You know, obviously we're down from previous levels, but what are we doing to move into that, to get further on? Just reaching out as far as we can doesn't seem to me like it's a good answer, and it's not an efficient use of our tax dollars. What is the Met Council doing to make this an efficient or as efficient as possible? Because obviously you're never going to, I mean, we'd have to charge people $10 to $20 a ride in order to make this break even, which is, you know, that's not really conceivable. We're not going to do that. But what are you doing to make this as efficient as we possibly can make it for taxpayer dollars?
And Chair Zelli, we just got a couple minutes left, so you can keep your answers as concise as possible. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's a great question, and I could take a lot more than the 60 seconds to kind of answer it. But I think the ABRT system in itself is incredibly efficient because it is integrating roads and buses and transit, which work together as one system. And we have to look carefully about the transit of the future. We know it's not just the express bus coming to downtown. That's hit down 90%. But other parts of the system are growing because, in many cases, this is how people get around without a car. So we want to make that efficient. We think of the transit of the future is more local, more everyday, and we need to be thinking thoughtfully about where those lines are and how we can best deploy them to meet the needs. So I think it's a wonderful question, and I look forward to showing you more examples of what that efficiency means.
Representative Olson.
Oh, that's good.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And here, about the electric buses, they cost more, and we need to subsidize that when we buy them. They're more than a diesel bus. Do we make up that cost later on with lower maintenance costs? I talked to somebody I know that had an electric car, and they said that was the one great piece that he didn't realize, that they don't have the oil changes and all that stuff. So does the upfront cost get offset over the life of the bus with less maintenance costs?
Chair Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. It's very different than a car. I know that driving an electric car, you save on fuel, you save on maintenance, less moving parts. A large vehicle has a much more robust system, and so there aren't immediate maintenance savings. But we think as the technology develops and over time, we think there will be savings both in maintenance and in fuel. But there isn't a direct, within the next 5 to 10 years that we see like in automobiles. But having said that, we think the technology is here to stay, and every year it gets better. And I think for us to be in the game, developing our own plans, developing the systems, will give us a head start to capture those efficiencies.
Thank you. And I'll ask a couple questions, then go to Representative Petersburg for the end. First, I want to piggyback off of Representative Kraft's comments. Is that I'm not saying whatsoever if an eighth of a cent sales tax is the right or the wrong way to go forward on this, but we know that our transit system, our dedicated money for transit, is woefully inadequate, and I was really surprised that an eighth of a cent is what came forward on this, and really disappointed that that was where that is, because we know that there's a lot more funding that is required, and I'd like for you and the governor executive side of things to be helping lead on that as to sharing and showing where we want to be going and how we do that. So eighth of a cent was, it's just not going to get us much of anywhere to get anything done that we need to. So that was one comment there. And then secondly, I don't see anything in here on highway BRT. Where we've got a plan for that, and it's not included in here. Where are we going, if anywhere, on that plan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not including many of the transitway developments that we are undergoing. The Gold Line is under construction, and that is a highway-specific, a dedicated lane bus rapid, transit. It is kind of under the under the FTA program, and it is certainly going to be augmented by the Purple Line, which is also in development, also a bus program, some on highway, some on a dedicated lane. So there are, like the Orange Line, which has been, we believe, a successful and efficient way of having these transitways.
So there's work. It's ongoing.
So those are ongoing capital programs, and we'd be happy to talk about those in the future, but it's not part of the ABRT system.
Got it. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Zelli. I've been in this committee now for 11 years, and you've been in front of us in one portion or all of that time, and probably longer, so you probably know the questions I'm going to ask, but I heard some disturbing things from you in which you've been predicting actually for a couple of years that we're coming to this $200 million structural deficit, actually above that, and yet you haven't done anything with it. And on top of it, your comments following that was, but we're expanding the system. You're in a deficit, but you're expanding the system, meaning expanding the programs. And so I haven't really heard anything about what the council is doing to try to bring that into line with each other. Because I want to remind you and everybody else, you have your own governing agency and governing programs. It is your responsibility to fix this fix the deficit, not the state to come in and fix it for you. And so do you have any ideas, as the council talked about, any ideas on how to get us back into more of a balanced budget situation?
Giselli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Petersburg, it's always an honor to be before you. We're talking about all different modes. But as we know, the Met Council's program is expanding into this interconnected transit system, which really requires kind of ongoing sustainable revenue, more than is currently in place. And what has been gratifying, but ominous, is that the federal recovery funds that came through this last period extended that deficit to now another 2 years from now. The structural deficit has always been there, but we keep kind of pushing it farther out. So there's no question that we need additional revenue, and I think the governor's proposal, and I think he is open to a higher rate, but the idea of actually having a metro sales tax is one that would be additional, not state revenue, but really delivering from the metro economy itself, the economy that's supported by this transit system.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just give some food for your thought. Sometimes when we balance a budget, it's not always about increasing revenue. Sometimes we have to create efficiencies and maybe reductions in some of the services that aren't as productive. So that may be something else that you could also consider. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Thank you, Chair Zelli, for being here. We will be in room 200 of the SOB next Tuesday, so just make sure everybody knows we're in 200 next Tuesday. Second thing is, everyone got draft language for transit safety. As Representative Brand mentioned, we're having a community meeting on Friday, tomorrow at 11 a.m. that everyone is welcome to join via Zoom if they would like. So with that, we are adjourned.